I'm Taylor Tarter, and this is Fastball Fantasy Baseball. On today's podcast, I'm starting a similar series to my review of sabermetric batting stats by looking at the first in a series of sabermetric pitching stats that I use to make a lot of decisions. And I'll talk to two of my fellow league mates about their differing draft strategies and some of the picks that they made. Let's get into it. Before I get started today, I just wanted to let you know that there's an awesome feature if you're listening on Anchor where you can send me a voice message from my podcast's homepage. If you have any questions or suggestions, or you have any, you know, start, sit, drop, add, or trade questions, feel free to reach out. Send me a message and I just may put it on the show. I recently wrapped up my series of batting sabermetric stats and traditional statistics that I used to evaluate hitters in fantasy baseball. Those included hard contact rate, BABIP, line drive, ground ball, fly ball percent, ground ball to fly ball rate, home run to fly ball rate, different plate discipline percentages, and walk and strikeout rates. And all of those statistics should be looked at in combination with each other in order to paint a clear picture of the hitter you're researching. And by looking at those stats, what you're doing is giving yourself a leg up on your fellow fantasy baseball league managers. If you look at those stats and take the time and do the research, you're able to make data-driven decisions for drafting players, starting and sitting players, dropping and adding players, and trading players. You'll be able to reasonably predict peaks and valleys, and you'll have a good idea of when to buy low and sell high. This week, the idea is to do the same thing, but begin focusing on sabermetric stats that can be used to help you analyze pitchers and their performance for the same purposes: drafting, dropping and adding, starting and sitting, and trading. So today, we'll spend time on one of the simpler stats to understand K9 or strikeouts per nine innings. K9, or strikeouts per nine innings, is a simple stat to understand. It's how many strikeouts a pitcher averages over nine innings. Now, rarely nowadays do pitchers go a full nine innings. This stat is not that. The way that this statistic is calculated is the number of strikeouts divided by the number of innings, and then that number is multiplied by nine. So, for example, a pitcher who pitches 150 innings and has 140 strikeouts has a K9 of 8.4. So that means they're striking out 8.4 batters over an average of nine innings. Conversely, a pitcher who pitches 140 innings and has 150 strikeouts would have a much better K9 rate of 9.6. The strikeouts per nine innings stat is important when evaluating pitchers because it helps you gauge how proficient a pitcher is at getting strikeouts and therefore getting outs, especially since most, if not every, type of fantasy baseball league values strikeouts. So this stat becomes super important to focus on and understand. FanGraphs offers an evaluation tool to help you, you know, make those decisions on players using the K9 stat. So according to FanGraphs, a 10 plus K9 is excellent. 9 to 9.9 is great, 8.2 to 8.9 is above average, etc. But for me, I simply don't even bother looking for pitchers with a K9 under 9, you know, with very few exceptions. You know, some of those exceptions deal with other pitching stats, which I'll review in the future. The reason I target exclusively pitchers with over 9 strikeouts per 9 innings is that I know from game to game, I'm going to have that category filled up. And I know I'm getting around a strikeout per inning from that pitcher. I also target these high K9 pitchers because these are typically pitchers who don't pitch to contact, and so it's less risk of hits. You know, these are some pitchers, typically, you know, low K9 pitchers, that when they pitch, they're hoping to get contact, albeit poor contact off the bat, in order to get outs. Pitchers like that who come to mind are Dakota Hudson, Marcus Stroman, Mike Soroka. These are pitchers that induced a lot of ground balls last year and relied less on strikeouts. And interestingly, those three pitchers in particular had lower ERAs than you might expect, but other pitching metrics, which I'll go over in the future, show that they actually overperformed last year. Now, looking this up, it's really easy to find on Fangraphs. We're going to be looking for top players here. So when you go to Fangraphs, what you do is on the top right-hand side where it says leaders, you click that, it'll give you a little drop-down, and you'll have the option to select pitching leaders from whatever year you want. If you go to last year, just scroll down a little bit, you'll see a dashboard with all the pitching stats, and you can click on whichever one you want to sort. So if you click on K9, it'll sort you from the highest strikeouts per nine number to the lowest. So you'll see that the top five there in K9 were Gerrit Cole, Max Scherzer, Robbie Ray, Justin Verlander, and Lucas Giolito. So, no surprises. Others rounding out the top 10, Bieber, Morton, DeGrom. Right? One thing you'll notice, though, is that a lot of the leaders in K9 are top pitchers in baseball. And this is why you want to target those players with a high K9 rate. On that screen, you also see other stats like ERA, FIP, which is F like Frank, I, P like Paul, and XFIP, which we'll get into in the coming weeks. K9 is a great place to start, though, when you're looking for pitchers to draft, pick up on the waiver wire, trade for, but as with hitting, there are a lot of other factors that play into helping you make those decisions. And in another couple of weeks, we'll do some more intensive player analysis in regards to combining some of those stats to evaluate players. Right now, though, let's just look at someone you can target that may be flying under the radar in your league. So just based on K9 data, a few players for you to look into are Matthew Boyd, Yu Darvish, and Max Fried. Each of them average more than nine strikeouts per nine innings, meaning that their starts are productive and are going to fill up your stat sheet. They're middle of the pack in walks, so there's little risk in that regard. Boyd and Darvish possess a little risk in terms of giving up home runs, but that's okay. Justin Verlander does too, and look at his numbers from last year. Boyd, Darvish, and Fried all strand about three quarters of their base runners, so if they have four guys that end up getting on base throughout the game, that means three of them are stranded on base. They're left on base. All three of these guys, though, were plagued last year by an inordinate amount of fly balls that turned into home runs, which raised their ERA. This year, I wouldn't be surprised if the number of home runs they give up is lower, and I know the season is going to be shorter, but prorated, which would lead to their ERAs being better this season. Players in your league might be ignoring them because of lackluster numbers last year, but we need to project to this year, and the likeliest outcome, in my opinion, is that we see some positive regression out of them, and they do better this season. So if you haven't drafted yet, try to snag them. And if you have drafted already, put those three guys on your watch list. And if they start to look good, go after them. I'll be right back to talk a little bit more about the draft with one of my fellow league managers. Today, I'm welcoming our most recent league champ to the podcast to talk about our draft and his strategy. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, I wanted to ask first, did you have a certain strategy you were trying to follow when you went into the draft? Were you looking for certain types of players or specific players? Basically, like, what sort of game plan did you have going in? And kind of specifically regarding those wraparound picks, since we did a snake draft and the knowing you had that long wait.
So, for starters, I hated having the wraparound. I always hate having the wraparound pick. I think it's I think it's a lot harder to steal value with that much space in between picks, at least when you're playing with other people that know what they're doing. But, you know, going into it, my first thing is, at least in the early rounds, I kind of reject the whole value for position approach. Like, I don't want to hear much about he hits well for a shortstop or hits well for something. I think that shouldn't come into play till later. So I kind of was doing the same strategy I always have, which is looking for, you know, power and good ERA pitching, a couple studs to anchor the lineup.
Yeah, and I totally get what you mean, like with the wraparound, like it's hard to find, you know, you're either at the beginning of the rush or you miss the rush on certain players and positions, and it's hard to get that sleeper guy. You're usually like reaching for someone if you do that.
Yeah, exactly. My hope is to just get a guy at value and then maybe even reach with one of the picks, you know, a guy that in a perfect world, I'd be five picks later.
Right.
Steal him, but, you know.
You can't count on him being like 10 picks later.
Exactly.
So you had the wraparound picks in the first and second rounds outside of our first four keeper rounds. You chose Mike Clevinger and Paul Goldschmidt. What was the thought process there? And did you have in mind that you were going, you know, pitcher first base? And let's start there.
So I was going pitcher and power, you know, and I also like a lot of reliability out of those early picks. And Goldschmidt is, you know, about as reliable as they come, who wasn't already kept. He had a slow start last year, but even by the end of that, he put up basically the same numbers he always had. He's on a lineup that's going to be competitive. It's a lineup that's going to score some runs. So, you know, I thought that was a good guy. And again, you know, the fact that he was a first baseman doesn't really scare me away because I don't really think that's a thing in modern baseball. And then Clevinger is like kind of in that sweet spot for me as well, where he's been around long enough that I know his good numbers weren't just that the league hadn't figured him out yet, but he's also not a guy that seems to have an impending decline.
Right. So was that factored into choosing him over like Patrick Corbin, Charlie Morton, Clayton Kershaw?
Yes. Yeah, so Kershaw is definitely that, you know, who knows when the decline will be, but it's certainly going to come at some point.
I mean, he's showing signs like getting injured and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And Corbin makes me nervous based on my strategy because, you know, as you know, I've talked about before on here, I'm one of those guys that goes with just a couple starters and mostly relievers. So a starter getting absolutely blown up is really problematic for me. And Corbin's a one-pitch guy.
He's risky there, yeah. I agree.
Right. And, you know, if that one pitch isn't working on a given day, that can mess up my whole week. Clevinger having more of a two-pitch option at least makes me feel like there's less risk of blowups.
Yeah, and so kind of going along with that strategy, right, you took the first reliever, Josh Hader, at pick 73. And so was that the game plan there? Were you going after him no matter what? You know, did you feel like this is the time to do it?
This year was different because I kind of felt like y'all were onto me. You know, this is my third year doing the, like, reliever-heavy thing and just hearing the talk on the podcast and in our chats. I felt more people were looking for that, so I felt I had to be more aggressive. Usually, I just kind of fill out my army of closers later on in the draft. But this year, I felt there could be runs. I felt I could end up without closers or without the, like, you know, elite guys. And the whole strategy of going relief pitcher heavy is dependent on that you're going with elite relievers, guys who have ERAs,
right,
ones or low twos. So I felt I had to be a little more aggressive than previously.
Yeah, and on that topic, right, so you had Hader, you drafted Jansen, Taylor Rogers, Gallegos, Hansel Robles, Keone Kella. You know, I talked to Jeff last week about his strategy in drafting relievers. He plays the waiting game. Yeah, I'm going to have Nick on later, he never drafts relievers. So what is your theory behind loading up on relievers?
So my theory is to win ERA and WHIP pretty much ERA, WHIP, and saves pretty much every week, and keep my opponent honest in strikeouts. I don't expect to win it. I have a few times, but I don't want my opponent to be able to just like pick his three or four favorite starts from the week and potentially give me a run at ERA and WHIP. So I want to be able to produce enough strikeouts with enough relievers that he's got to throw all his starters, which ideally, like, you know, me and you have talked in private before that I don't think there's a whole lot of B starters. I think you get A starters and then C starters. And I want to make sure he has to throw his C starters.
Right. And you know, I think we should probably be clear, like, this is a 5x5 head-to-head category league. Right. And so nailing down three pitching stats like that could be like super, super important to winning on a weekly basis. And so that's, you know, it's a strategy that I adopted. I've seen it work. And so this year was like, you know, like you said, I've been talking about it. And so that was, I kind of followed your lead on that.
Yeah, you know, I fell backwards into it. It's kind of a couple of years ago that I just couldn't get my pitching right and decided to give this a whirl, and it worked out well.
It definitely works. It definitely works, and the strategy is, you know, sound.
Yeah.
So I'm also very jealous of your Lance McCullers pick at 137. I thought he was a great sleeper pick coming back from an injury, but man, he could be a really special pitcher, especially in this shortened season where he's had that extra time to recover, you know, and get right. Is that how you view him, as kind of like that sleeper that could be really special? Or were you just thinking like right time, right place, need a starting arm?
No, I was thinking about taking a risk in this. I intend for him to be, you know, come with that curveball we all saw in the playoffs a couple years back and be just elite, especially like you said, probably without any kind of innings cap because of the shortened season. So, you know, the thing with having such few starters and the relievers, that whole strategy is it actually opens up a little bit more flex on the bench where I can take this guy and hope he works out. And if he does, then I'll drop him and I'll figure out something else.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing because you have, if you're drafting, you know, those top relievers and keeping that ERA low, then you can take these risks where Lance McCullers, you know, he might walk a few people and his WHIP might go up. But if you have all those relievers to kind of balance that out, then, you know, that could be the pick, you know, the pick of the draft.
Yeah. And early in the season, I can be cautious with him. I know, you know, I don't actually manage his health, but I can decide, you know, I'm not going to start him against, you know, the elite lineups until I
play the matchups,
especially late in the week. I can see what's going on, not be forced into that decision.
So what do you see as your strengths going into this season? And for me, I think your power across the board is great. And I also, we've kind of been talking about it, I think your pitching staff is excellent.
Thanks. Yeah. Those I definitely think are my strengths. Like I said, especially if McCullers works out, I'm very happy with the pitching. I actually think I might have one reliever too many. I might, or at least one closer too many, depending on how the season plays out. I might even drop a lower end closer and look for a higher end setup guy that's going to keep the ERA on strikeouts. Outfield's my weakness. It's always my weakness. And, you know, I feel like these leagues were almost designed when the power and the best hitters were in the outfield. And now we've got five spots to fill there. And really it's
third right.
base, it's second, middle infield that are the best bats.
Yeah. And so, well, before I kind of chip in there, you and Matt have the most players on your team that I wanted, like in the draft, like you guys took so many players that I was like, I'm about to pick them. And then they're gone.
Yeah.
But you're so kind of on that topic of your weaknesses. I had down that I thought your outfield was like a little top heavy. Like those first two or three guys are really legit, but I agree. Like, I think you're going to have to find some, you're gonna have to like play matchups a little bit or stream a couple guys until you, or maybe like figure out a trade or something. But I, you know, it's hard to find a bad spot on your team.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. I can't wait for it to get started.
I know, and hopefully it's getting started in July. That's what it's looking like.
That's what it's looking like. I want to hear somebody other than Trevor Plouffe say it, but you know, I'm hoping.
Yeah. All right, man. This was awesome. Thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
Next up is a returning guest. To remind everyone, he holds our league record for most wins in a season, and he holds the record for the highest winning percentage in a season and for the career in our league. And he's won 2 championships in the 7 years he's been in the league. Nick, thanks for joining me.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. I appreciate when you tell everyone how awesome I am at this game, or lucky, or whatever it is.
Which adds to the cred.
Hey,
so the first thing I want to ask you, you know, we're talking about the draft. So did you have a certain strategy you were trying to follow when you went in? Were you looking for certain types of players, specific players? And then you picked at number 6 out of 8 in a snake draft. Did you, you know, how did that factor into your game plan?
Cool. So I definitely had a strategy. My strategy was based on who my keepers were, and those were Lindor, Tatis, Mookie, and DeGrom. So my strategy was to kind of build on their strengths, which are stolen bases, average, and runs. So I knew that those were going to be 3 strong categories for me, that if I tried to pick up players who are similar to that, that I would do okay. And then I also, with my strategy, tend to, I like to call it kind of pocket aces. I want 2 top 10 pitchers. So I always want to make sure I'm doing that. And then I don't ever draft any relievers. That's always my strategy as well. And we can get into that if you're curious as to why I do that. And then lastly, picking from 6th, man, that's not a fun spot to be in. It was, I think the first time I've ever picked from the 6th spot. In the past, I've picked from, I like picking last, or I like picking first. It was nice to come in 3rd place, but I don't like picking in that. I don't like picking in that 6th spot because I felt like it made me not adhere to my strategy a couple times. It bothered me because there were times where I took players based on positions versus necessarily my strategy and trying to fill my team up, which I don't like to do that.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get into some of those elements coming up. Cool. So straight out of the first 4 keeper rounds, you went with Corbin as your first pitcher after keeping DeGrom. Yep. What was the deciding factor in taking Corbin over somebody like Luis Castillo or Charlie Morton?
Sure. So who I really wanted, which is by my struggle, I was really hoping the first 3 pitchers off the board were Verlander, Strasburg, and then the guy that I really wanted was Clevinger. And he went 3 spots before I took Corbin. And I think I took Corbin. For me, Luis Castillo is definitely going to be a top 10 pitcher, but he's still young and, to me, unproven versus someone like Patrick Corbin. It could be a pick that if I go back on and you know, in the future, look back on, might be upset at myself for it. I also think, too, a lot of times people look at Patrick Corbin and think his ERA is high.
Right.
But when you look at the league-wide ERA and even what, like, the ERA, like, the best ERAs were in our league last year, his ERA is not that much higher than it. That I'm not really concerned about it. you know, I mean, it's not as good as someone like, you know, who goes way later in the draft, like Mike Soroka, or even anywhere near as good as DeGrom's. But I think it's going to be similar enough to Castillo's and Morton's that I kind of went with that hometown pick, someone who's been around for long. I mean, he's 30 years old compared to Castillo, who's what, 24?
And, you know, ballpark, I'm sure, played a factor with Castillo sure. in a home run park. And
for sure.
You know, and like you said, you know, the ERA isn't, we shouldn't be thinking about that so much, especially with the way the baseball played last year. You know, it was mm-hmm. flying all over the place for everybody. So, you know, I'm sure that factored in as well. And then, you know, Corbin's also going to fill up your stat sheet in other places too. So even if you do lose a little in ERA, you're getting those strikeouts, you're getting, you know, those quality starts in our league.
For sure.
I'm also interested in your thought process in taking Josh Bell over Matt Olson. And, you know, interestingly, they went back to back in our league, in our draft.
Yeah, so I think they're very similar. I think after Matt Olson, first base kind of just tails off. I think Bell and Olson are in a similar category tier, if you will, for me. They're very similar players. I think Josh Bell will probably hit a few more home runs. His average won't be as good as Olson's. But I really like the upside, and you'll notice a theme as we kind of talk about where I drafted and some of the decisions I made with the potential for the short. I mean, it's going to be a shortened season. If we have a season, Josh Bell's first half last year was just monstrous. I would say he was the best first baseman in the league for the first half. I'd have to go back and look at numbers, but he was just off the charts. And if they only play 80 games and he can recreate that, to me, that upside was greater than Matt Olson's, who's been in the league for a little bit longer. I mean, really, they both hit the ball really hard, right? They're both going to hit tons of home runs. So for me, it's kind of a toss up, but I went with the upside and Bell.
You kind of know what you're getting with Matt Olson, and you know, you're hoping Bell kind of like adds on to what he did last year.
100%. And I think really in a draft like ours with eight teams in a league like ours, I think you kind of have to take some gambles on some players, because those are the, you know, the way that you win a league. Because really, Matt Olson's good, but if I get someone better in Josh Bell, you know, that makes a huge difference in the league with eight people compared to if we had 10 or 12.
And, you know, I think it's easy to take risks. You know, it's a small risk, but you know, to take those high upside guys, I think it's easy to do that when you have keepers, and especially when you have players already, like, you know, Lindor, who can hit for average, Tatis, who can hit for average, and you know, you're going to get like 20, 25 home runs from those guys in a normal season. You can take that shot on Josh Bell and say, you know, maybe he's going to get me 20 home runs in half a season. You know, yeah. he hit more than that in the first half last year. He tailed off in the second half, but you know, if you get first half Josh Bell from last year in a half season this year, could be a you know, one of the most important picks on your team.
Yeah, for sure.
So another great pick for you, I think, is Giancarlo Stanton. You picked at number 59, and we draft on ESPN, and they had him way down their list. And, you know, it's presumably because of all, you know, the injuries that he's been dealing with. You know, we kind of talked about it in our draft, how, you know, He's going to be fine to start, likely, and he could hit the most home runs in the league this year. You know, are you like me in thinking that?
100%. I went in kind of targeting him as someone who, because of the fact that we're starting so much later into the season, those injury concerns are not really there for me. I mean, if he's healthy, I think he's absolutely going to hit the most home runs in the league. Oh God, I'm blank on his name. The first baseman from the Mets.
Alonso.
He might hit more. But he was, I'm sure somebody kept him, right? Like he was probably a keeper for somebody. So, you know, if he's close to that and I got him in round 8, like 59, okay, I'm in.
They could end up with the same batting average too. They're, you know, you might have gotten a keeper at pick 59, you know.
Absolutely. And again, that for me is what some of these middle rounds, for not even middle rounds, but like, you know, round like 5 through 10 for us, I think you have the potential to pick somebody who could become a keeper for the future. And that's kind of what I'm hoping for sure. Is Stanton or Bell even. I mean, he could be the best first baseman in the league next year. So
later in the draft, round 12, you picked Michael Conforto over fellow outfielders, Michael Brantley, Victor Robles, Franmil Reyes. What was your reasoning there?
It was a dumb reasoning. I was hoping to get a pitcher there. I had really wanted Brandon Woodruff and he got taken. It's a perfect example of not following your strategy. You know, looking back at it, it might work out because it's a shortened season. Again, I kind of went into the draft with that mindset of I'm going to take guys who could have been an injury risk in the past. And I think Brantley and Conforto and even Robles, I think they're all in like that same tier. I don't think one of them is like hands down way better than the other. Like I'm not upset that I got Conforto and I don't think it's going to hurt my team, but it didn't fit my strategy. And I saw that I needed an outfielder. And I had been hoping for a pitcher in that spot. And ultimately just I kind of panic picked and was like, Conforto, like I need the home runs. Home runs are like, people are starting to pick players that are hitting lots of home runs. And it was silly. I should have taken, if I went back and looked at it, like Brantley, and you talked about it on a previous podcast episode, you know, Brantley would have been amazing for my average. That's one of those that like you tell people stick with your strategy, don't do what other people are doing. And I was kind of persuaded by what was happening around me.
And then a couple rounds later, you chose Corey Kluber over other kind of mid-tier pitchers, Lance Lynn, Sonny Gray, Robbie Ray, Mike Soroka. What was the thought process in taking Kluber over some of those other guys?
Yeah, I think there's, for me, in my mind, I think there is some bounce back potential for him. He's not the top 10 pitcher that he used to be, but I think there's still potential for, you know, maybe top 25. I mean, he's still got a pretty good fastball. It's slowed down a little bit, but his breaking pitches are still there. He's, again, for me, one of those upside. It's in that ramp. I know that I've already got Giolito. I think I already had Giolito at this point. I had Giolito, Corbin, and DeGrom. So I'm thinking, all right, if I can get another top 25 pitcher at this point, I would rather take that over someone like, you know, who else were you saying I skipped on?
Sonny Gray.
Yeah, so I know you really like Sonny Gray. Robbie Ray, though, for me, he's probably the only other one that I would have considered. The guy who I really wanted in that spot was Jesus Luzardo. Again, taking three guys right before me.
It always happens, doesn't
even Jose Barrios. Both of them, you know, two guys that I would have taken. I think they have huge upside. So again, Kluber is that potential upside if he bounces back. If not, I know what I'm getting. He also has that name with him. And I think there's some guys in the league who, if Corey Kluber has a couple good games in a row, I could easily flip him for somebody that might upgrade my team if someone's interested and needs starting pitching.
And, you know, maybe you flip him for a reliever.
Yeah.
Because next question, one part of your draft strategy every year is, well, for most years, is that you don't draft any, or you draft very, very few relievers. And why is that?
I think that people overpay for saves. And I would rather get my saves on the waiver wire. I would rather get my saves. And this is because we're an 8-team league. Because there's only 8 teams, I think there are so many guys out there on the waiver wire. And I was looking at it just yesterday in terms of who's still sitting out there. And, you know, there's players out there that their ERA might not be the greatest, but they're still going to get me a save or two a week. And as the season goes on, people will also, I've seen this historically, people are so quick to give up on relievers. They have someone who burns them 1 week. And unless you have one of the top 5 relievers, it's going to happen. Like, you're going to have a guy who's just going to absolutely be awful 1 week. You know, like Taylor Rogers from Minnesota, he's going to have a week where he's awful and someone's going to get frustrated and drop him, and I'll be right there to pick him up. Maybe I won't be there now because everyone's going to know that's my strategy. But I think that being able to pick up relievers is a better strategy for me to have an overall team. And last year I finished 2nd in the league in total saves, and then still top 3 in ERA and whip in both of them. So that's why I don't do relievers.
I just looked this up too. Since 2015, you have been in the top 3. So 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you've been in the top 3 of saves for those years.
Dang. Okay. I really think what the bigger takeaway from this for anyone, the people who are listening, is I don't overpay for saves, but also if you don't do that, you have to be active, or you have to just completely punt the category. Right. And you would think I'm just going to completely punt it and say, I don't want to even touch it. But if you're active, you get guys who are getting saves and you can be competitive in it.
It's more of a wait and see approach for you rather than I'm just going to ignore it approach.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, I want to point this out because I just talked to Mike and he takes the exact opposite strategy. He goes out and looks for, you know, he tries to draft a few of the top closers so that he knows, you know, he's going to get 20 to 40 saves out of, you know, these 2 or 3 guys, and then, you know, drafts a couple others that have some upside. And, you know, it's interesting because both work. He won last year, you won the year before with totally different strategies. And I just think it's kind of interesting, you know, in that. But it's also important for people to know, like, if you're going to follow this strategy, stick with it. Don't change absolutely halfway through the season.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at his team, he's got Clevinger. He's got McCullers, who could be lights out, Chris Paddock, and then the rest of them are all relievers, which is the exact opposite of mine. It's amazing, the difference.
So, kind of wrapping up here, what do you see as your team's strengths this season? And for me, I think you have, you know, a really strong pitching staff because obviously you drafted all starters and you got a couple of the top ones. You know, I see a good balance of power and speed. I see good positional, you know, flexibility. You got a lot of guys that can play a lot of different positions.
For sure. And I did that intentionally. I want to, in an 8-team league, be able to field as many players as possible. In fact, even some of my guys on my bench, like I chose them because of their positional flexibility, like Scott Kingery and Garrett Hampson. And if either one of them is someone who doesn't, you know, do well in a shortened season and doesn't, you know, I think in a shortened season, it's going to be essential that you can't have slumps. I'm happy to drop one of them and even use a spot as a streaming bench player. But I agree with you. My strength is definitely my average and stolen bases. I don't think that I will lose very many stolen bases weeks. I should have that category pretty much locked down. Between Lindor, Tatis, then if you know, I got a couple guys that will steal bases for me for sure. I'm nervous about RBIs and power. But I think I'll be okay there. I'm not going to win every week. There's some guys whose teams are just stacked in terms of RBIs and power. But overall, I'm happy with it. I've got some. I really like some of my late round picks. I got guys like Bumgarner, who I really liked as a late pick. We'll see how it all kind of shakes out depending on when the season starts. But I'm happy with where I'm at.
Yeah, and kind of along the same lines, you know, as far as weaknesses go, I really don't think you have very many. You know, I think, you know, the RBI, that can be fixed. I mean, you have a ton of good pitching. So, you know, if it takes, you know, one pitcher to swap and you get RBIs and then, you know, another category you don't have is saves, then there you go, you know, and problem solved. Those are the only places where I think if you could improve, I think those are the only spots.
For sure. And, you know, I think one of the things that people could do more of in leagues is look at some of their strengths that you have and figure out a way to kind of capitalize on them to improve the others. So, like, I could probably give up a guy who has double-digit steals to someone who's nervous about that category a couple weeks into the season because they keep losing it and they want someone with steals. I could probably do that to boost my home runs or average, and I don't think that would be an issue with the team that I have to give up someone like Tatis. I mean, that's a scary thought because he's a keeper, but I think what you're saying, and I agree with it, is you got to be willing to look at your team and say, all right, even though I drafted him, and I know where some of the other guys were saying this is an issue, but even though I drafted him, I could still trade him.
Like, right.
I'm not stuck with, you know, Lindor. If someone wants him and can give me the right thing for him and make me a better team, let's go.
And for my listeners, if you didn't listen a week or two ago, I talked about, you know, this exact thing, finding your strengths and your surplus and you know, being willing to trade to get something that you're weak at and finding that thing that you have that somebody else needs. So it's good to hear you know, that other people get it.
Yeah, for sure, man. That's the way that you got to be active, right? If you don't make any moves or trades and you're stuck with who you got, you're not going to get better, and then, you know, then you get relegated or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to talk about that off air.
Mm-hmm.
All right, man. This has been awesome. Thanks for joining me again.
You got it.
Well, that's all for today. Thanks to my two guests for joining me. Listen in next week when I'll be talking about FIP, the next pitching stat in the series of Sabermetric pitching stats.